So welcome to Professor Stanley Wells CBE at the Shakespeare Club, Stratford-upon-Avon. Stanley, this conversation is really about, in a way, how you became the leading Shakespeare scholar. And I thought I'd start by asking you, what was your first literary encounter? Where did it all start for you, this fascination with words and poetry and drama?
Well, I came from an unlettered family. There were no books at home, but I went to a grammar school. I went first to a primary school in Hull in East Yorkshire, and then I went to a very good grammar school. It was a perfectly normal grammar school for its time. It's called Kingston High School. It no longer exists. And I was lucky enough to have some very good teachers there. And also I developed an interest in reading even before I went to grammar school. I remember when I was about 9 or 10, I suppose, reading the Pickwick Papers. And I read it one weekend behind the sofa in the sitting room of our house in North Road, Hull. And my chuckles and giggles and laughter astonished the rest of the family. They had no idea what was going on, that I was finding something so amusing and so entertaining. And then my father, who was a manager of a bus company, knew the editor of the local paper. And the local, that man said, "Oh, I can sell you a complete Dickens for £5. So he did. So that started me really on my intensive reading career, I think. But when I went to grammar school, I was lucky enough to have a very good English teacher. I suppose my first memories of Shakespeare, actually, were reading round the class, as we used to do in those days. It was a pretty barbarous way of being taught Shakespeare, really. You all went round, each of you read the next speech as it came. And we were reading, must have been the Midsummer Night's Dream, because I remember reading a line, "Oh, hell, to see love through another's eyes." Is that right? Not quite right, is it? Oh dear, oh hell, that's a very naughty thing to have to say. We were very innocent in those days. So I realized that I was reading Helena in that particular moment. I also remember standing up in front of the class with a ruler, being Julius Caesar, or being Cassius or Brutus in these. We used to stand up for Shakespeare even in those days. The RSC didn't actually start standing up for Shakespeare.
Tell us about Mr. Large, your English teacher.
Yeah, Mr. Large was a remarkable teacher. I didn't get him, though, until later up the school. He was the fifth and sixth form
teacher. Did Shakespeare start before then for you?
Yes, Shakespeare started in the first form with the Midsummer Night's Dream.
And then
Julius
Mr. Large
Caesar.
Was the sixth form.
Mr. Large came in the fifth and sixth form when we were doing GCE, what was it called in those days? What? School cert, school certificate, and then higher school certificate. That's right, yeah. And I had some contemporaries around. And, and he was a very inspiring teacher. I remember he really awoke me to Shakespeare's language, I think, through Sonnet 29, the sonnet beginning, "When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes." And that was the sonnet which really opened my eyes to the glories of Shakespeare's language. And interestingly enough, Paul and I, just at this very, very, just currently, in the recent couple of days, writing an article about that sonnet for a book which is to be published next year. And that was an eye-opener. And one was able to go to theatre in Hull in those days. I used to see Donald Wolfit, great actor, old ham in some ways, toured around the country, toured Shakespeare, with a company of actors who were not particularly distinguished. He rather tended to surround himself with inferior actors, unfortunately. Trevor Nunn, when I was in Denmark, recently told a story about Donald Wolfit, about him saying at the end of a performance that the next performance would be of Othello, in which his dear wife would play Desdemona, and a voice from the gallery said, "Your wife's a whore." And he said, "Nevertheless, my wife will be paying Desdemona." He was a great actor, though, in his way. He was a very fine Lear. And I was able, even in Hull, in the provinces, in the war and just afterwards, to see some great performances. I remember seeing Sybil Thorndike and Lewis Casson, for example, in Priestley's play, The Linden Tree. And when I heard that Sybil Thorndike was coming to Hull, I thought, yeah, it was a bit as if Sarah Siddons had been descending on a cloud. I'd read about her, this great actress.
And back to Mr. Large.
Yeah.
What was it about him that was so inspiring as a teacher?
Well, he was highly intelligent. He was a wonderful reader. Of course, he did tend to take all the best parts himself, but then so did I later when I became a school teacher. He was a very charismatic sort of figure and very cultivated, unusually so. Very interested in music as I became, and he helped to develop my musical tastes as well as my literary tastes. He had some very distinguished pupils. Tom Courtenay, for example, Sir Tom Courtenay was a pupil of his. So was John Alderton, who became well known as a television actor. So was Malcolm Story, who was acted here, for example. So it's touching to me to think of the influence of that man going on through a variety of Shakespearean and literary endeavours.
Do you think, I mean, music played an important part for you as you were growing up. Do you see that as formational in terms of your appreciation of poetry and the literary imagination?
I'm not sure that it's got... I'm not sure that it's symbiotic. Music, in some ways, I'd rather have been a musician than a literary scholar. I learnt to play the violin very badly and never improved. But music has meant a very great deal to me over the years. And when I decided to apply for university, I applied for London partly because I wanted to be able to go to concerts as well as to plays in London.
And you went to UCL?
I went to University College London, yes, where my professor was a man called Charles Jasper Sisson. He interviewed me in 1947. In Foster Court, which is still where the English Department of University College London still is. And he was a formative influence in ways that we might get onto a bit later, perhaps.
Well, we may talk about it now if you
want. Okay, well, the fact is that...
Winifred Watney was also there
were some wonderful teachers there. I was lucky. It was a very strong English department. Harold Jenkins, who became the Arden editor of Hamlet, for example. Winifred Watney, who was a rather reclusive... Very, very intelligent teacher, wonderful lecturer, but very intense, very austere. She wrote a very good book called The Language Poets Use. She ended up, sadly, as a sort of bag lady. She was almost too intelligent for her own good. But she was a very inspiring teacher. She gave wonderful lectures on King Lear, for example. Terence Spencer, who later became my mentor and my... And I became his right-hand man when he was director of the Institute, was a lecturer there too. It was a very fine and very strong English department.
These are like four great Shakespeareans.
Yes.
You've just mentioned all your tutors.
Yeah.
Well, Sisson, Watney, Spencer, and Jenkins.
Yes, all of them very distinguished Shakespeareans, that's quite true, yes. But they weren't always interested in theatre. I remember Mrs. Novotny once, I went to London, I said, partly because I wanted to be able to see plays, to see theatre, and I was very lucky in that way. I saw Olivier play Richard III on stage, for example. I was able to see Gielgud's Leontes in The Winter's Tale. In a Peter Brook production, Edith Evans in a number of plays, Olivier and Vivian Leigh in Antony and Cleopatra, the same season they did Caesar and Cleopatra at the St. James's Theatre.
Just remind me in terms of dates, where are we in relation to the opening of the National Theatre and Olivier's work?
Oh, before that, well before that.
The idea was obviously very alive.
The idea had been going since the early years of the century,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
But it took an awful long time to come to fruition. But Olivier was the obvious leader of the theatrical profession at that time.
Did you see Gielgud?
Yes, I saw Gielgud. I saw him in The Winter's Tale in the Peter Brook production at the Phoenix Theatre, a very beautiful production, which Lewis Casson, Sybil Thorndyke's husband, played Antigonus. It was a very beautiful production indeed. Yes, I have vivid memories.
And
of
do you remember at the time thinking which of those actors you preferred? They were both leaders of the profession, really.
Yeah, I preferred Olivier. Olivier knocked me back. I mean, he was the charismatic... I don't know, he was a very great actor. Gielgud was a wonderful actor, too, in his different way. I perhaps a bit unlucky. I didn't catch Gielgud at his greatest time as a Shakespeare actor. The Winter's Tale was splendid, but and I did see a late Tempest that he did, but I never saw his Hamlet, for example. But Olivier was the really great thrilling actor. And especially when I came to Stratford and saw his Coriolanus, which I think the greatest performance of anything I've ever seen, that really did knock me back. And I saw his Othello in Birmingham a couple of times too. So those were the great performances for me.
So it was an exciting time to be an undergraduate at UCL.
It was, yes.
And did you then went on to become a school teacher?
Yes, I did. I went to the RAF, as I had to. I started my national service. I was going to do Russian. At that time, if you were a graduate, you had the possibility of applying...
Becoming a spy.
Becoming a spy, precisely, or learning how the spies operated. And I was going to do a course in Russian at Cambridge, which would have been a pretty cushy way of getting through national service. But in the end, after 10 days in the RAF, I got a duodenal ulcer and was invalided out.
So that might have been Wells 007.
Yes.
So after that, you became a schoolmaster?
After that, after drifting around like a librarian for a bit, I did become a schoolmaster in Hampshire, yes.
Near Jane Austen's house.
Near Jane Austen's house, yes. In a village called Oakley, near Basingstoke, which was near Steventon, which Steventon Rectory was where Jane Austen lived, and she'd visited the house on a number of occasions, fairly well before my time.
And how long were you a school teacher?
About 6 years.
And you taught Shakespeare?
I taught a bit of Shakespeare, yes. It was a rather ramshackle school. It was rather like the school in Decline and Fall, in Evelyn Waugh's Decline and Fall. We had to improvise our goalposts, for example. I had to teach games, highly unsuited to that, though I was. I was in charge of the fourth team in a small school of about 100 pupils. And we didn't have any regular goalposts for that team, so we had to improvise with branches of trees stuck into the ground. I remember at one point in the game shouting out, "Moulton, remove that goalpost, replace that goalpost," because the naughty Moulton had taken the goalpost out of the ground. It was a very ramshackle school, but yes, I did have to teach Shakespeare to some extent. Not easy in a multi, because there were a lot of foreigners in the school, people whose native language was not English, who came to the school to learn English. But because there were more foreigners in the school than there were English people, instead of the foreigners getting an English accent, the English people started getting a foreign accent from the foreigners.
Did you find yourself emulating Mr. Large from your own school as when you were teaching Shakespeare?
I suppose I did, really, without consciously doing so, yes. Of course, in those days, we used to teach English language. We taught punctuation and parsing and analysis and so on, and a good job it was, too, in my view. I still occasionally look at letters I received from my pupils then, and the punctuation and the spelling in them is far better than that of a lot of the graduate students I got 30 years later. We put them through a rigorous language training. But yes, Shakespeare was difficult to teach to young people. It always is and always will be, of course. And one of the great problems was deciding at what stage to introduce young people to Shakespeare.
What do you think about that, Sammy?
I think it depends on the children. I think it's not right to try to impose Shakespeare on children who don't have the receptive capacity for it. But at the same time, we had to do Shakespeare because they were going to be doing it in their exam when they were 16. So I had to decide which point to introduce them. And I would worry a great deal about that. If it had a good class, of course they were all individuals anyway, but you saw them as a class, then I might start when they were about 13. I might wait till they were about 14, but I couldn't leave it any longer.
You have a perfect antidote to the view that, oh, just take them to see it live in performance, because, oh, it will just change everything. This production of Henry IV.
Yes, I took my pupils once. We were doing Henry IV, Part 1, to persuade children on the page to reading that Falstaff is funny is a bloody difficult job. The words that Falstaff speaks on the page are not funny, frankly. And so I thought, well, I'll take them to see the play. So we went to to see Robert Atkins, who had been a great Shakespearean in the 30s and 20s and 30s. He was touring, but he was not a young man any longer. And he toured in the Theatre Royal in Portsmouth. We were not far from Portsmouth. So I took my boys there to see a matinee performance of Henry IV, Part I, which we were studying. And we were almost the only people in the theatre. It was a cup final day. There was no television in those days, so Robert Atkins was playing Falstaff in a deaf aid, and he was playing it not as a part of the characterisation, he was playing it because he needed the deaf aid, and it was not a funny production. I just wish I'd stayed at home and let them listen to the cup final on the radio.
But from the school, you came to the Shakespeare Institute. How did that come about?
Well, I was not well paid as a schoolmaster. I couldn't afford doing much in my holidays. But I'd been to Stratford once. I had a week here, staying in the old Red Lion, I think it was, and saw four productions, including Barbara Jefford, who is still with us, of course, as playing Katharina in The Shrew. And Anthony Quayle was the director then. So I had a week here. But then when I, after being a schoolmaster for 6 or 7 years, I got rather bored during the holidays. So I thought, well, I'll write to the Shakespeare Institute, because my old professor, C.J. Sisson, had come here as senior research fellow. And I'd studied paleography. I'd studied Elizabethan handwriting as an undergraduate under Sisson. And so I thought, well, perhaps I might be of some use. I might be able to transcribe some manuscripts or something for them. So I wrote to the Institute and said, would they be interested in some voluntary work for a couple of weeks? And I stayed at a boarding house on Rother Street, kept by a lady called Mrs. Richardson. Michael Coveney often talks about her. He stayed at Mrs. Richardson's house. Park View, it was called. You can imagine what sort of a park view you had on Rother Street, but there was a little bit of grass just visible from the upstairs windows. And I stayed here for a couple of weeks, and I did some transcribing from microfilms, and at the end of that period, Allardyce Nicol, who was the director, who'd been on holiday, came back, and he was told I'd been quite handy around the place, and so he said, would you like to apply for a scholarship? To work for a PhD, so I did.
And that was the turning point.
That was really a great turning point in my life, yes.
So you took the scholarship.
I did.
And that led to a PhD.
Yes.
On
Robert Greene. I edited two works by Robert Greene, Pandosto, which is the source of The Winter's Tale, of course, and an even worse book called Perimedes the Blacksmith. But that took 3 years of my life here. And during that period, because I was older than some of the students, I started here when I was 28 in 1958, I did quite a bit of teaching for the British Council. The British Council was very active in Stratford in those days. Very charming lady called Phyllis Mann, some of you may remember, she had the offices here. And the offices were in Halls Croft at that time. And so I came here, I came into this room. It was still very much as it was, except that there was silk around these lampshades.
From Marie Corelli's day.
From Marie Corelli's day, yes, indeed. The room was, the building was a bit more Corelli-ish than it is now, but not all that much more.
And Allardyce Nicol believed in saturating the scholars at that time in the Renaissance texts. You had the microfilms, the microcards, and he sort of put you all to work on those.
Yes, he was a versatile scholar, though. He was a great historian of the theatre. That was his great work. He wrote the enormous Cambridge history of the English theatre, multi-volume work. But he was also interested in the Renaissance generally. And he built up this enormous collection of microfilms here. In those days, before the internet, that was the best way to get a knowledge of old books, unless you were in London in the British Library or in the Folger Shakespeare Library, for example. So we had all the microfilms. You had to read on these scratchy old films that came up on a screen, and you got the early printed texts. But he was also a great theatre man, you see, and he started the Institute here mainly because he wanted to bring together the worlds of the academy and the theatre. He was an idealist in that way. He started the Institute at the time that Sir Barry Jackson was appointed director of the theatre here. And the idea was that the theatre and the academy would work together, scholarship and the theatre would go hand in hand. It didn't work. It never will work. It didn't work partly because Sir Barry didn't last long at the theatre. He wasn't a successful director, artistic director of the theatre here. He had a row with the governors. But it also foundered mainly, I think, because there was an idealistic view that the theatre could be made to take an interest in the academy and the academy in the theatre. On the whole, the theatre is not interested in the academy. This remains true.
And we're talking about a theatre with a capital T.
Exactly. Yes, of course, not simply the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. Yes, the world of a theatre. I think, I think it's quite right that they should work on their own. They have their own mindsets, their own degree of creativity. But on the other hand, one of the great things in my lifetime has been the increased academic interest in the theatre. Mm-hmm. One of the great pioneers of that was somebody who was here at that time, which is John Russell Brown, still a friend of ours, who was a great pioneer in the bringing together. He started the theatre department in the University of Birmingham, for example. You see, all the theatre departments in England have started since I was...
Also, John remains among the handful, it's not even a handful, of academics who have been dramaturges.
Yes, indeed. John is a man of incredible energy, who always needed two careers running simultaneously. And so while he was a professor in Birmingham and then later in Sussex, he was also an assistant director at the National Theatre. Yes, extraordinary man.
Now, around about the time you were finishing your work on Robert Greene, the RSC started down the road in 1961.
Yes.
And in terms of the Academy and the theatre, one of the things it seems to me that the RSC has prided itself on, and British theatre the last 50 years, is that if you get enough directors from Oxbridge, you create a sort of quasi-Academy theatre connection. So John Barton and Peter Hall arrive down the road.
Yeah.
You were aware of this as a major thing happening in
61? No, I don't think so. Not quite like that. You see, the theatre was here already. It was already a very successful institution. Before the RSC started, we had the wonderful season, the Jubilee season, the 100th season. It was a bit of a fake, actually, but they had to conflate one or two seasons to make it the 100th season. But that was when we had this extraordinary season, when we had Olivier and Edith Evans, both of them appearing in Coriolanus, where we had Edith Evans in Tyrone Guthrie's wonderful production of All's Well That Ends Well. We had Paul Robeson playing, not very well, playing Othello, with Sam Wanamaker playing Iago. Albert Finney was at the beginning of his career, was understudying Coriolanus. So the theatre was already a great theatre before it became the Royal Shakespeare Company. But it's true that what you say, that it shifted from a theatre dominated by highly intelligent theatre people from other also highly intelligent theatre people who nevertheless had received a university education. Anthony Quayle was not, I believe, a university man. But the influence fundamentally of David Rylands in Cambridge and Neville Coghill in Oxford began to percolate into the theatre, so that you had these university graduates, Peter Hall, John Barton, and others. Not sure about Peter. I don't think he was.
No.
I don't think of him in terms in the same university terms as the others. Of course, he is a great director. But it didn't seem all that much of a revolution when it became the Royal Shakespeare Company. It was a new naming.
And Stanley, the practice of bringing actors in, theatre practitioners in, to talk to students, to work with students, can you describe to us your role in that?
And yes,
were you a sort of instigator of that?
Yeah, I became director of the Theatre Summer School in, I suppose, 1971, rather later than I was first here. But I'd been attending their meetings. And as a dedicated theatre goer, because I did go a great deal to the theatre, I remember seeing Dorothy Chutin's Twelfth Night, for example, Peter Hall's Twelfth Night, at least a dozen times, and I went a great deal, partly because I was employed to do so by the British Council and would have discussion groups and so on. But once I became influential here, running courses here, well before I became director, but I was the fellow in residence here when the Institute went up to Birmingham. So I would invite theatre people to come to talk to the courses that I was running here. So, for example, I remember inviting Judy Dench to come to speak to a course from the University of Montpellier, who still come to us. She was very nervous about this, so she brought Richard Pascoe and Barbara Lee Hunt along to hold her hand during the course of it. Ian Richardson would come and talk to our courses. Musicians, too, David Munro, the great musician who died sadly young, would come and do concerts for me here. So, yes, I did try to make the Institute a meeting ground for the theatre and the Academy, and to some extent that was successful.
So this was an innovative way of being true to the Institute's founding principles.
Yes, I think so, yes.
And tell us about the university politics in relation to the Institute, because it was not a given that the Institute would remain in Stratford.
No, it wasn't.
And it moved to Birmingham.
Yes.
But the Nathancroft was obviously kept by the university.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were living here.
Yes, I actually lived alone in this building for 10 years. I had a couple of rooms here. And during that period, the Institute moved up to Birmingham when Allardyce Nicol was succeeded by Terence Spencer as director. And partly because Spencer himself lived in Birmingham, was professor there, but they wanted to hang on to this building. So I was left behind, very happily so, actually, as the fellow in charge. And during that period, I developed a number of courses in order partly to make use of this building, this beautiful and fine building, courses, some of which are still coming to us. With these courses
How did you do that, Stanley? Did you write cold to universities in Europe, or did you meet people at International Shakespeare Conference?
Well, Daphne might remember something of that. It just grew in a way. It partly through British Council contacts, through other contacts, people writing to us sometimes and saying, could we bring a group of students to Stratford? And once it became known that we were willing to do this, it grew and became a very useful source of revenue, but also a way of keeping this building occupied and keeping it useful as a university centre.
And the landmark productions for you during this time, during your time at the Institute, I mean, just pull them out of the air in terms of the productions that you really remember, recall, because they were controversial or especially...
Well, there was, as I say, early on, there was the early Peter Hall productions. Trevor Nunn came in very early, of course. Trevor's Revenge's Tragedy, I think it was about 27 when he directed that. It was a brilliant production, wonderful production, done more or less on a shoestring. John Barton, of course, helped to rewrite the play. John was a great rewriter of Shakespeare and his contemporaries. But The Revenge's Tragedy with Ian Richardson, Helen Mirren, Jeanette's mother, Brenda Bruce,
Brenda Bruce.
Alan Howard, Ray Ian was a great production, and that was on the back of a Hamlet. It was in the used the same costumes because they were doing it on a shoestring. So that, over the years, I was particularly fond of John Barton's productions of the comedies. John, of course, is a very intelligent and highly educated Cambridge graduate, and the productions that he did of Measure for Measure with Ian Richardson and Estelle Kohler, of All's Well with the same people, he did a fine Coriolanus, he did... he rewrote, of course. He was a terrible rewriter of Shakespeare. I mean, the Wars of the Roses, which is so popular here in the centenary season, I think it was, he wrote 1,400 lines of pseudo-Shakespeare for them, and that did disturb quite a lot of my colleagues. Kenneth Muir got very cross about that, I remember. But still, they were brilliant productions. And Peggy Ashcroft playing Queen Margaret right through four plays, for example. Peggy's... Catherine in The Taming of the Shrew in John Barton's production was a very beautiful thing. So it's interesting that I'm talking partly about stars, aren't I? But that's not perhaps entirely... These were not star-dominated productions in the way that Wolfitt's had been. Wolfitt was... You had no doubt who was the lead with Wolfitt. But actors like Peggy Ashcroft, like Bruce Mason... You had fine actors who were not quite star actors, mm-hmm. as we still do, of course. David Waller was one of mm-hmm. them, who played bottom for Peter in the Peter Brook, the groundbreaking Peter Brook production of The Dream. These were actors who could play within a company, yet who had star charisma as well, and that was a great thing.
Around about the same time, or let's say in the mid-60s, comes the Penguin Shakespeare.
Yes.
And you were involved with...
I was involved from the start
Terence Spencer.
Yeah. I was his stooge, really, his dog's body in many ways. And we planned the Penguin Shakespeare here. I remember having meetings, hours-long meetings, which we planned it. And we argued for hours about whether we would have the notes at the bottom of the page or at the back of the book. And it was a very important decision. Mm. Eventually, we decided to have the back of the book. And I'm very glad we did, because the Penguin Shakespeare is now the only Shakespeare of any consequence, the only Shakespeare edition, where you can read the plain text without Dr. Johnson said, notes refrigerate the mind. And your mind is not refrigerated when you're reading a Penguin Shakespeare.
It's Samuel Johnson's birthday today.
Oh, hooray! Yeah, happy birthday,
Samuel Johnson. Happy birthday, Dr. Johnson.
And St. Lucy, yes.
So the Penguin Shakespeare started here.
Yeah.
An early project for you was A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes,
that
was my first Shakespeare edition.
Can you just reflect on that and your memories of editing Shakespeare in that way for the first
time? Yeah, I had edited Green for my PhD. I then did an edition of works by Thomas Nash, just as a one-off thing. But then when the Penguin Shakespeare started, Terence Spencer asked me if I would like to edit a play, and I said I'd love to edit A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I did. That was the first of the Shakespeare plays that I edited. I suppose I wanted to do it partly, actually, because I'd seen the lovely Peter Hall production with sets by Leela de Nobili, which was very fine. And I enjoyed doing that. And then I went on to edit Richard II and The Comedy of Errors for the Penguin Shakespeare, too.
And the Penguin Shakespeare was... Cymbeline was missing, wasn't it, for a long time?
It was.
It wasn't quite completed for some years afterwards.
No, for a long time afterwards, no, but it's complete now.
So, Stan, you became president of the Shakespeare Club in 1971.
Yeah, I used to go to the Shakespeare Club before then, of course. I remember it met usually in Halls Croft in those days. It was a smaller organisation. And there were some rather remarkable characters involved. There was Miss Taylor. She was the secretary. Miss Taylor was, in both senses of the word, a miniature painter. She painted miniatures, and she was about 3 feet high. And she was deaf. I'm sure you know the syndrome, and she would always tell every speaker, speak up, speak up, speak up, speak up. And there was a man called Mr. Darlow, who had been the headmaster of the high school. He was a secretary in those days, and he was quite stern, too. And I spoke to them very early on. And at one time, I was the youngest ever speaker to have spoken to the Shakespeare Club, but who succeeded me?
Oh.
You did. later, you became... You spoke to the club when you were even younger than why I was when I'd first spoken to them. So, yes, I used to go to their meetings, and then they elected me president very kindly in, what was it, 1971. And I gave... my presidential address then, actually, was about... I gave a proper lecture then, not just a chat. And I talked about three great Shakespeareans, about Allardyce Nicol, Terence Spencer and C.J. Sisson, my predecessors.
What makes a great Shakespearean, Stanley?
How interesting. I think that what makes a great Shakespearean has varied over the years according to the state of Shakespeare's studies at any given time. I think now the demands are rather great if you're going to be a concentrate on Shakespeare because of the fact that the theatre has become so important in Shakespeare's studies. I'm a I'm a jack of all trades in this way, you see. I'm an editor of Shakespeare, but I'm also interested in Shakespeare in the theatre. I write Shakespeare criticism. I write Shakespearean, the history of Shakespeare's reputation. I write about that, as you said. I've never written a full biography of Shakespeare. But ultimately, what really matters to be a great Shakespearean is to love Shakespeare. I mean, to be moved and appreciative of the greatness of Shakespeare's genius, of his dramatic and poetic talents.
It seems to me that the 60s into the 70s was a sort of decade of hats. Different hats were accumulating for you to wear.
Yeah.
Because around that time, I think even the same year, you became a trustee of the Birthplace Trust.
Yes, yes.
What are your early memories of the Birthplace Trust?
Well, of course, I was involved. I mean, going back to that time, I go back to 1964. Let's think about in 1964 was the great quatercentenary, of course. And I was, I think, already involved with the Birthplace. And that was the year that the Shakespeare Centre was opened. We also had a great exhibition, the celebratory exhibition, which was directed by Richard Buckle, who was a dancer, a ballet critic. It lost thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of pounds. But I sat on the committee for that with Fordham Flower as the chairman of that. And at the same time, the centre was building its new building. Levi Fox, of course, was the director at that time. So, yes, I've been involved with the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust for many years, too.
And when did you become involved with the Royal Shakespeare Company as a trustee?
I think I became a governor of the theatre. It must have been about 1971, actually.
Yes, it's the hats.
Yes, because I was appointed director of the Theatre Summer School in succession to John Wilders, who'd succeeded John Garrett, who founded it. And I was appointed director of the Theatre Summer School, and about the same time I was made a governor of the theatre. So I served for many years as an active governor of the theatre, becoming vice chairman of the governors, and being deeply involved with the activities of the theatre.
Wasn't it about the same time that what became the International Shakespeare Association had a sort of founding conference in Vancouver?
Yes, it did. I wasn't present at that. I was too junior to be invited to go to that. Terence Spencer went to that. But yes, the International Shakespeare Association started also around about then. And I've been involved with it since the following conference. You know, I didn't even go to the Washington one, actually. We had one in Stratford. I've forgotten what year that was.
Susan, 81?
1981. I remember that vividly, mainly because at the final banquet we were all given a chocolate statuette of Shakespeare. that's been a long-going endeavour.
And towards the end of the decade of the 70s, Oxford University Press got in touch.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, I'd done some work for Oxford University Press. I'd advised on a number of projects, and I'd edited a couple of volumes for them, bibliographical guides, a bibliographical guide to Shakespeare and one on the rest of English drama. I brought together a number of essays on those, and I'd advised on a number of projects, and they, I suppose, liked what I'd done. So one of their senior editors came to Stratford to talk to me and said, would I be interested in becoming the general editor of an Oxford Shakespeare? They'd been trying to get a new Oxford edition for many years. The previous one had been first published in 1891, and they'd appointed a number of people to try to get a new edition to replace that, and they'd followed the traditional pattern of trying to get people in university positions to do it in their spare time, in their vacations and so on, and it didn't work. They never got round to finishing it. So they had the brilliant idea of appointing somebody to a full-time position. So I was invited to become the first head of the Shakespeare Department of Oxford University Press, with the prime responsibility of producing a new edition of the complete works of Shakespeare for Oxford.
With a fellowship at one of the colleges?
Well, that was not on the cards at the start, but after I'd been there a year or two, Balliol College offered me a research fellowship as a way of keeping me involved with university things, but it wasn't part of the job.
Now, obviously, your scholarship till that point alerted you very much to the size of the commission.
Yes.
The overwhelming expectation that a brand new, freshly edited edition of Shakespeare would be for you to do.
Yeah, it was a heavy, very heavy responsibility.
Enormous.
And of course, you know, whenever I said, in the early years of my appointment, when I would say to people in Oxford, to fellows at the college and so on, they would say, what are you doing here? And I would say, I'm editing a new Oxford Shakespeare. And in the Oxford way, one eyebrow would go up, and the left side of the mouth would also go up a bit. And say, oh, is it going to be any different from any other edition of Shakespeare? Well, in the end, it was very different
very
from any
different.
Other edition
And it's still different.
And this disconcerted some people, because it's the first edition since the 18th century to be edited from Shakespeare's own texts. Edward Capel had done it in the 1770s, I think it is. Every other edition since then had been based on the previous edition, on an earlier edition, revising what Pope or Theobald or C.J. Sisson or whatever had done. But we did insist, or I insisted, that we should go back to the original texts, which was the first time it had been done for a complete works. And I'm glad we did, and it resulted in an edition which is different, which is different.
It also meant that you had to radically think through the issues such as modernising spelling.
Absolutely. The first 3 or 4 months of my appointment, I was still living in Stratford, and I spent mostly in the Shakespeare Centre Library working on what became a book published under the heading of Modernising Shakespeare's Spelling, along with some essays by Gary Taylor on Henry V, because nobody had thought seriously about the presentation of Shakespeare with modern printing conventions. They'd always just tidged around with previous editions, so that many of the earlier editions still used very Victorian-style punctuation, for example.
If I mention just briefly the Riverside Shakespeare,
just
as a comparison to crystallise what we're talking about, how would the Oxford Shakespeare compare to the Riverside Shakespeare's treatment of modernising?
Well, a few years before I was appointed to Oxford, the Riverside edition, the American Riverside edition, with the general editor, Blake Moore Evans, came out. And I remember seeing it in Terence Spencer's room in Birmingham and saying, this seems to me to be a retrograde step in Shakespeare editing. It was a rather pompous thing to say. But I thought it, because the Riverside edition consciously adopted a number of old spellings in order, as they said, to give a flavour of the Shakespearean language. So, that, for example, Henry V in that edition is spelled Henry V, F-I-F-T. And I thought that was just bloody silly, frankly.
A dolphin, not the dauphin.
There's a dolphin, not the dauphin, and all that sort of thing. And yet it didn't do it consistently, you see. It did it on the mistaken assumption, the mistaken belief, that Elizabethan spelling reflects Elizabethan pronunciation, which it doesn't. You have to know about Elizabethan spelling in order to deduce the pronunciation from the spelling of the time. And I was determined that we would have a fully, that you would either have Shakespeare in old spelling, which is a perfectly legitimate thing to do. In fact, the Oxford Shakespeare does exist in an old spelling, an original spelling edition. Nobody's ever read it. Very few people have ever bought it, but it's there if anybody ever wants it. I remember when I was editing, I rang a professor of language in Oxford, who'd been a professor in Birmingham, and I said I was modernising Shakespeare's spelling, and I asked for any advice that he as a linguist had to give. And he said, oh, you might as well read Agatha Christie as modernised Shakespeare's spelling. And I said, well, what edition do you read your Shakespeare in? Because every edition of Shakespeare was modernised, like the Globe, for example, but not consistently and not rigorously. So that was for me a very important thing.
And at some point with Oxford University Press, did you have to argue for a team to be built around you for this project?
Yes, there was some resistance within the press to the employment of people by a publishing firm who had nothing to do except be scholars. And they thought it was a cushy number. It wasn't, in fact, it was very hard work. But I was allowed initially to have an assistant editor, and I appointed Gary Taylor, a very young man at that time, very inexperienced, and he became, eventually, he developed very rapidly, became a very great scholar, as he is, and became my co-general editor. And I also was able to appoint John Jowett, who's now a professor here, and Bill Montgomery, to help me to bring the thing to completion.
And if you hadn't done it, it wouldn't have been done in 10 years.
No, it couldn't have been
done. No way.
No, it was done in 8 years, actually, the actual edition.
And during that, you also instigated, as under your own general editorship, the single volume.
Yeah, the
multi-volume individual play editions of Shakespeare for Oxford.
Yeah. You see, I was appointed to produce complete works, of single volume complete works, but we saw a gap in the market at the same time for a multi-volume edition. The Arden edition at that time was in the doldrums. The new Cambridge edition had not started, and the Dover Wilson edition was already badly out of date. So I thought we could start a new, ambitious, scholarly edition. So we did.
And the first volume appeared when, Sonny?
1981, yes.
And the last volume appeared
this
in
year.
2011.
Yes, yes.
So it took 30 years to do a complete
multi-volume edition with different editors from outside the press doing those. I did King Lear myself, and I co-edited Twelfth Night for it. But those were farmed out to other scholars.
And it was completed this year with Richard II.
Yes.
And that makes you the only person ever to have achieved such a thing.
Yes.
Ever. To have overseen an entire multi-volume edition of Shakespeare by different editors, doing, you know, proper critical editions with full textual notes of individual plays.
Yes.
Hurrah!
Yes, I was pleased when that happened, yes.
And then from Oxford you came back to the Institute and became professor.
Yes, I was lucky enough. I worked myself out of the job at Oxford, you see. And indeed I started applying for other jobs. I applied to be a librarian at Trinity College, Cambridge. I was interviewed for that stupid idea, really. I'm not a librarian. They didn't appoint me very naturally. But then I was lucky enough that the director of the Institute, Philip Brockbank, retired, and I was lucky enough for this job became open at the time that I desperately needed a new job. So at the age of, what was I, 57, I suppose, I was appointed here as director of the Institute. And that was a very happy time for me. I came back to Stratford. I'd lived in Stratford for most of my professional life since then, after being a schoolmaster. And I came back to Stratford, and I spent the next 7 or 8 years as professor. I was the first ever professor of Shakespeare studies. There are quite a lot of them all over the place now. But I think I was the first ever person whose chair was actually named as a chair of Shakespeare studies. And that brought me here back home in a way. Of course, although quite a lot of my reputation, such as it is, built upon publications, the foundation of my career is actually teaching. I've been a teacher not only of school children, but also of students, of undergraduates, and especially of graduates. I think I must have supervised 70 or 80 PhD theses, for example. And that, in some ways, that's the thing I'm most proud of having done. I've developed very good relationships with my students. I think a lot of them have appreciated what I've been able to do for them. And that's the sort of subcurrent to my career, which the less public side of it. But I think I think teaching is of the essence of my work and of my being, really.
Stanley, thank you very much indeed.